This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson. You're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. I'm thrilled I have a great guest for you today. It's Michael Perry, who once worked as a roller skating Snoopy. He's a humorist and the author of the best-selling memoirs Population 485, Meeting Your Neighbors One Siren at a Time, Truck, A Love Story, which is one of my favorite books, Coop, A Year of Poultry, Pigs, and Parenting. He's also written for Esquire, The New York Times Magazine, Outside, Backpacker, Orion, and Salon.com, and he's a contributing editor to Men's Health. Off Main Street is a collection of his essays, and his latest memoir is Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. Michael's also performed and produced two live audience humor recordings, I Got It From the Cows and Never Stand Behind a Sneezing Cow, and he performs regularly with his band The Long Beds. Michael and his family live in rural Wisconsin, where he remains active with the local volunteer rescue service. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Well, thanks for having me.
I really adore your books because you celebrate ordinary people. I have a lot of friends who write children's books, and the books that I like best are things like one of my friends, Maribeth Bolts, wrote Grace and Joe about a postman who used to walk with her, let her walk with him on his route when she was a little girl, and Nan Nelson was a student of mine, and she wrote about her the woman that used to clean house because her mother was a career woman when there weren't that many of those around. Her book was called My Day with Anka. But your books are in that same stream, except for adults. And I'm wondering, your latest book, Visiting Tom, features Tom and his wife, Arlene, and they had some health scares. I'm wondering how they're doing now.
Well, I just stopped in to visit them the day before I left on book tour, and they were doing pretty good. Arlene's health is failing. She's showing some wear. But in the book, I write that their goal was to make their 60th anniversary, and in the book, they had made it to their 59th. And I am happy to report that since the book was finished, they just celebrated their 60th anniversary. So they made that milestone. And as far as Tom, I think the best way to describe his health is that the last time I showed up over there, it was pretty hot, and he answered the door. He was just wearing a pair of cut-off jeans, and that was it. And when I asked him what he'd been doing, he said he just chased a bear out of the yard with a stick. So he's doing pretty well. He said it was messing with his bird feeders, and when he hollered at it, it wouldn't leave, so he grabbed a stick and went after it.
So this is in your neighborhood, right?
Yeah, they live about, depending on whether you drive or go as a crow flies, a mile or 2 miles from where I live. And that was kind of the point of the book, is Tom's not my mentor, I'm not his acolyte, I don't go to him seeking wisdom. I think I wrote in the book, I usually just go to him seeking nothing more complicated than a 6011 welding rod. What I really wanted to write about was what you can learn from just being neighbors, and he's quite a neighbor.
It was a great book. It talks a lot about, in a subtle way, you give us lessons in equanimity and patience. One of the things I enjoyed was that Tom is such a hoarder, and there was one line in the book where he has just used a trampoline frame that he had in his yard to help you with something, and then you wrote that he was beaming the triumphant grin of the vindicated hoarder.
My wife has to put up, I have similar hoarding tendencies, and I have all these boxes full of things out in the shed, and she's always trying to prevail on me to trim some of that stuff down. But then every once in a while, I was working. Matter of fact, you mentioned the book Truck, and in there I write about a very humorous incident I had involving a fake parking ticket. And when I was writing that, I thought, I think I saved that ticket somewhere. And I crawled up in the roof of our garage. I spent an hour going through boxes, and sure enough, I found the ticket. And that way I was able to write the story very specifically. And that was one of those moments where I showed it to my wife. I said, see, there's a reason I keep all these things. This is how I make my living. And of course, she just rolls her eyes. But Tom, that reminded me of that moment when Tom pulled that old trampoline frame out and was so proud because he found that he was using it for a jig for bending some steel. And he just said, yep, I knew there's a reason I saved that.
Well, he seemed like a pretty creative guy.
Oh, yeah. I call him a roughneck polymath. He's one of those fellas that he's mostly self-taught, and he just absorbs and retains things. It's amazing. I was over there helping him gather honey one day, and he started rattling off statistics and facts about bees. And I mean, he could teach a master course, and he reads things, and they stick. And that fascinates me because I have almost no memory, and if I don't write things down, and I capture pictures in my head real good, but the actual useful data escapes me, and he just is full of wisdom and knowledge and specifics, and then combine that with his creativity and his lively interest in life itself, and you get quite a character.
Yeah, it sounds like a good neighbor to have.
He is, yeah. He's a good neighbor. There's some history. He was very good to, I didn't grow up in the area, but my wife grew up in the area, and her family went through a rough stretch when she was in her teen years, and Tom and Arlene were very good to her, and so they're good neighbors in that sense. But he's also a great neighbor in that if you need I did a video for the book, and it's up on the website, sneezingcow.com, where you go to visitingtom.com, and in that, on the voiceover for that video, I say I go to visit Tom when I need a piece of iron cut, bent, or welded. And so he's a great neighbor in a very practical sense, too. He's always helped me. I had a piece of equipment that cracked, and I took it over there, and he welded it up for me.
Well, a few more decades, and you may be the Tom of your neighborhood.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that question.
A few more decades, and you may be the Tom in your neighborhood.
Well, that's very nice of you to say, except if you've read many of my books, you know that unfortunately, despite the fact that I'm a blue-collar guy from a farming background, I worked on a ranch, and I know how to run a ranch, and I can do some bubblegum welding, but my mechanical and carpentry and fundamental useful talents are pretty limited, and it's a great frustration for me in that I know how to act around engines and welders and sawmills and stuff, but you really don't want me running them.
Well, that's a good point. So, but you do have the ability to paint wonderful pictures, and your prose is so rich with sensory detail that I always feel like I'm right there with you. And I noticed that you have had and a lot of exposure to poetry. You mentioned in one of the interviews I watched about you that you admired Dylan Thomas and his talking about tasting words. So did you grow up reading a lot of poetry?
Not poetry. I came to poetry later in life, but the biggest blessing in my life was my mom, who I grew up in a church that we weren't allowed to go to movies or watch TV or dance or things like that, but my mother was a voracious reader, and she took me to the library and filled our house with books, and she taught me to read when I was four, and she taught me to love reading and words, and so I had that hunger built in. And then when I got older, and I had no idea or intention of being a writer, but after I got out of college, I started going to some poetry readings, and I fell in love with the way that poets use words and approach words and language, and you mentioned my favorite Dylan Thomas quote is when he talks about choosing words for their taste over their meaning. And so I owe a great debt to poets living and dead, known and unknown, because they helped me really fall in love with the idea of language. And I try to sneak a little bit of that into the nonfiction prose whenever I can.
Well, your writing does have a very lyrical, musical quality in places. But on the other hand, it's also leisurely. It doesn't have that, you know, conciseness of poetry where everything is really brief. You take the time to set a scene and really get us into the story, but then every so often you'll just have something that's really richly rhythmic. I love that about your writing.
Oh, I appreciate that. Yeah, I try to mix it up a little, because there is no question, and this comes up in reviews occasionally, but anyone who wants to read me, they got to have a little patience, because I tend to go off on tangents, and I will take some time to tell you exactly what it looks like in the shop there, but if you hang around, then I try to also deliver some humor and some more rat-a-tat stuff to offset the longer passages.
And you also tie things up. Like when I started reading Visiting Tom, I wasn't exactly sure where we were going, but by the end of the book, there were these parallels between what had happened to him and what had happened to you in relation to roads and transportation issues. And, you know, like the farms.
You know, I'm glad you said that, because I try to, for a long time when I first started writing, I would try to wrap everything up very neatly, and I would try to write very seamless prose and take the reader by the hand and say, oh, be careful, we're going over here now, follow me, there you go, I'll help you across here. And I had an editor and friend who's still my friend, and he's just from the small town where I went to college, but he would just get on my case all the time. He'd say, give the reader some credit. They'll come with you. You don't have to tie everything up so seamlessly. And then another big breakthrough for me is sometime in the mid-90s, I read a collection of essays by Jim Harrison called Just Before Dark. And he would be writing about ice fishing in Michigan, and then there'd be some white space, and he'd be talking about drinking an $800 bottle of wine in the south of France, and then there'd be some more white space, and he'd be talking about Hollywood, and then there'd be some more white space, and he'd be back in Michigan. But when you got to the end, it all came together and made sense, and that was a big influence on me. And so now I do go off on tangents, and there's a lot of white space, but I hope if I do it right, and that when you get to the end of the book, you understand. And even in this book, features some photography by some friends and photographers of mine, and the way that the photographs are treated in the prose, I don't let anybody know why it's even there until you get all the way to the end, and that was a little chancy, and I didn't know if people would come along, and we'll find out as people read it, but I like the idea that if you just hang in there, when you get to the end, you'll understand why. Why we did it that way.
Well, we don't want to give anything away, but describe a little bit about this camera. So this was a vintage camera.
Well, a couple of vintage cameras. Yeah, the photographers are, there's some folks that, I love to say this because it's true, we met in prison, and then after I say that, I have to admit we were actually just there to do a story, but there are a couple from Wisconsin, Manitowoc, Wisconsin, and they're cheeseheads just like me, although they're much more artistic, and they're very intellectual, but they also grow their own food and have an old international tractor they bale hay with and fix themselves. So they're this wonderful mix of art and dirt, and they do wonderful photography. It's John Shimon and Julie Lindemann, and they work almost exclusively with vintage cameras. They do some digital work just to come into the modern times, but and they brought some of their vintage cameras and spent a day at Tom's farm and followed him around. And initially, the only reason I had them come over is because they tend to photograph people like Tom. And I just thought, well, that would be great. They'd like that. But as I followed them, I realized that Tom was basically taking us on a tour of his life, because every time we stopped for photographs, he was telling stories that tied into the location. And so I was feverishly writing all this down and recording it. And then when it came time to write the book, I just couldn't figure out how to use it. And for a while, I had that day as chapter one, and I had it as the last chapter, but it just didn't feel right. And then so eventually, I just sliced up the day and interspersed it between chapters all the way to the end. And it was just a pleasure to write about their process, too, because there's a great tie-in to their patience, the way they work with photography in this modern age. And then Tom, of course, being this old-timer in a modern age.
Yeah, we forget now that a lot of us are using digital photography, where you can instantly look at your camera and see what you've just taken and whether you need to shoot three more pictures. But this was a process where they didn't know how the pictures were coming out. And it sounded like...
And my favorite photograph to come out of that session was one where they just had to go on faith. They were trying to capture, and it now is featured in the book, they were trying to capture Tom and an iconic silo, and also a giant semi-trailer going 70 miles an hour. And they had to get this all at once. And as I write in the book, they were using an old vintage camera where every time you fire, you're burning a big, expensive piece of film. And you also have no way of knowing if you got the shot until, in their case, 2 days later in the darkroom somewhere.
Did they... email you and let you know it worked, or did you not know until you opened the package of...
I didn't know until I opened the package. I knew that I think they took two or maybe even three shots, but I was just thrilled when I saw what they eventually got, and that photograph is in the book.
Yeah, that's a very striking photo. So
It tells his whole... I've been joking about the fact that that one photo tells... In one photo, they've captured what I took an entire book to try to say.
Well, you gave us, you could feel the story from looking at the photo, but you gave us the details that we wouldn't be able to intuit. So one of the things I've been interested in is that I read about your working process on your website a few years ago. I don't know if it's still, you still have that particular entry up there, but you talked about using triangles and circles and squiggles and having little cutout pieces of paper all over the room. And it really appealed to me because it just seemed doable. Do you still work that way?
Unfortunately, yes. I think if people only knew how I struggle. This does not come naturally to me, and I can't keep a thought straight in my head, and I go off on tangents, both in my writing and just day-to-day. I'm just very, very scattered. And the upside of that is those tangents are often what yield some of the more interesting perspectives, at least from my point of view, and take me down unusual paths. But to try and put a book together is just this massive undertaking, and I can't keep it together in my head, and I can't keep it together on screen. And so there are photographs on my website, even if you poke around there, of me trying to work, and I print things out and cut them up. I cut up paper and pieces of text with scissors, and I move them around on the table, and I reposition them, and I do a lot of editing that way, and I tape things to the wall, and then as I get chapters that are starting to take form, I tape them end to end, kind of like a Jack Kerouac roll, and so that I can stand over them and read them in one continuous line. And so for me, I just have to break everything down into actual physical parts and move it around, and then try to finally get it to where it hangs together.
So it's a visceral process. It's an actual physical.
You're reacting to, does this feel? Because I certainly don't have the I don't have the academic background to really, sometimes I had someone one time say, "Oh, that's a very interesting use of parallel structure." And I said, "Well, thank you." I really had no idea what parallel structure was. And so I'm doing a lot of stuff intuitively, planning by ear, really, to put it in musical terms. I've just educated myself by reading a ton of other writers, and also hanging out with writers and academics who do have that ability. Some of my best writing friends are academics, and I just so admire their knowledge of process and their ability to diagram things and understand it on that level. And so I try to absorb as much as I can from them.
Yeah, you probably have through osmosis, not just from being around the writers, but from all the reading you've done. It sounds like you were voracious.
I was so heartwarmed recently. I was at an event where the author Neil Gaiman was speaking, and of course he just has millions of followers all over the world, and there was a huge crowd there, and someone asked him the usual question, what does it take, if I want to be a writer, what should I do? And I thought I was very interested to hear what someone that successful and that dedicated, his work ethic is tremendous. I was interested to see what he would say, and I was so happy because he said exactly what I say, except not as many people listen to me, and he prefaced it by saying, "Well, you're going to be very disappointed with my answer because it's not very exciting, but it's the only answer." And he said, "You need to do two things. If you want to be a writer, you need to read and you need to write." And it really does come down to that. And in my case, being a guy who, I wasn't going to college to be a writer, I have a bachelor's degree in nursing, and I was learning to write while I was working as a nurse and making a living however I could, and that's how I learned. It was just reading and reading and reading. And I was obviously learning how to write from the time I started reading at 4. I just never got around to actually writing. The writing part was out of college and working in another profession.
I wanted to remind listeners, you're listening to Crew 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. This is Cheryl Fusco Johnson on Writer's Voices. I have a fabulous guest today, Michael Perry. He's going to be coming to Iowa soon at Prairie Lights Bookstore on Friday, August 30th from 7 to 9, and he has written quite a few very popular memoirs. If you're interested in hearing him read from his latest book, Visiting Tom, you might want to make a trip to Iowa City soon. So you yourself have said that artistry stems from showing up with the intent to be honest. And I have a question about that, because you do write a lot about people in your life. So has Tom seen your book, and how did that work once it was published?
Yes, he has seen it. And part of the deal here was, Tom's my neighbor first, and he's a subject second. And out of respect for that, I asked his permission to write the book. And he gave me that permission with one exception, and that was that he wanted me to change his name, which I did do. And that's fair. I want to protect his privacy as best I can, while nonetheless writing about nearly every aspect of his life. And so in that sense, he was fine. I also, once the book was in final form, I went through it with him several times, not for the purpose of changing anything, and he didn't ask for any changes. And I don't work that way, but I did go through it with him to fact check things, and went through it with him several times. And I also went through it with his daughter, and I was trying to explain to him that it's very important that I get the facts right, and because if in the nonfiction genre, of course, there's a lot of controversy about that, and I do my best. I make mistakes, and if they're found and pointed out politely, I put them up on my website under the tag "Oops." If you go to sneezingcow.com or visitingtom.com and you look for the "Oops" tag, you'll see where I've done this in the past. But I just worked real hard to let Tom understand that I needed to get things as accurate as possible, and he was real helpful in that regard. And basically, he just said, "Oh, yeah, I think you did a good job," and that's about what you get from where I come from. Someone says, "Oh, I think you did a pretty good job," and then he turns around and he's telling everybody, and this is where I shudder as a nonfiction guy. He says, "Well, but because you changed my name, I'm telling everybody it's fiction." So, I said, "Tom, that's going to cause me some trouble," but that's his decision he's sticking with it. But yeah, he's fine. You know, here's my favorite thing is that now the book is done, and when I go to see him now, it's not to do fact-checking, it's just to be his neighbor. I went over the other day, took him some eggs, and we shot the breeze on his porch and talked about many things, none of them to do with the book.
Well, it makes it a little easier for you, so now when you go over, you don't have to think about recording things or writing down details.
As I said, I mean that from my heart, he's my neighbor first and a subject second, and now that's done, and we're back to just being, not that really anything changed, it was just continuing to be neighbors with him, but of course I was taking notes and paying a little closer attention.
Now, your first book was about your work as an emergency medical technician and going around and being on accident scenes. And you mention in this book, this, it's a Portuguese word, is it saudade?
You know, I have no idea how to pronounce it. I've had people email me and talk to me at readings and tell me how to pronounce it, and I've gotten four or five different versions from people who claim they know, even. So I've always called it saudade, but I'm sure
saudade.
That I'm mangling it.
Okay, yeah. That sounds good to me. We'll just go with that, saudade.
Okay. With all apologies to those of you who are fluent in Portuguese.
And so would you explain what that concept is? And also the second part of my question is, do you feel that all the things that you've seen, you know, being at these accident sites, do you feel like that's kind of cultivated, like a sort of feeling of nostalgia in you?
No, but I'll get to that. So,
okay.
Saudade, as I understand it, is, and this is a rough rough definition, but it's this sense of longing for things irretrievably lost. And so I suppose it's somewhere in there with sentimentality and reminiscence, but it's something sweeter and deeper, I think, and so I find myself swept with it often, and as far as how that plays into the ambulance work, and I've been doing that since 1988, so I'm approaching 25 years of that, and I'm still active with the local service just as a volunteer, and I don't make near the calls I used to because I'm on the road so much, but I still respond, and the reason that I continue to be active with the volunteer fire and rescue service is it's something that I enjoy from the point of view that it's practical and useful as opposed to sitting and typing essays. The payoff on that is sometimes a little more obscure, but grabbing your bag and going to an accident and stabilizing somebody's C-spine while they're extricated from a bad car wreck, that seems like you're doing something fundamentally useful in the moment. And the other thing is that I'm no big shot. I mean, I'm pretty much a self-propelled book tour guy. I'm out here on my own driving around with books and going to bookstores. Everywhere I go, no one recognizes me, so it's not like it's a big deal. But nonetheless, if you spend your time in that world too long, you can start to perceive yourself as just one sort of person. And what I love is I can go on a book tour like this and have wonderful readings, and they're a blast. I really enjoy doing readings and meeting all the people and saying thanks to their face. But then you come back home, and a lot of times it's the middle of the night when I get back home to my little farm, and when I hit the county line, I turn my pager back on, and it goes off at 2 in the morning like it did just the day before I left for tour, and it's a little neighbor lady who's having, you know, in some distress, and you try to go help, and in the process, you're just reminded of your own mortality and that you're constantly reminded of what's truly important and relevant, and very little of it has to do with I keep doing it because I enjoy it, and I keep doing it because it keeps me in line.
So that's interesting, and it also keeps you really connected with your community in a, you know, vital way.
So that's true. I didn't think to say that, but I think I wrote in one of the other books, I really am, despite the fact that I made my living in public pretty much, I'm pretty shy, and I can get up in front of, like, when I do readings, they're a blast, because I do a lot of humor, I tell a lot of stories that aren't in the book. I mean, I just have come to really enjoy readings, and I do a lot of one-man monologue shows and stuff. But day to day, if you met me at the store, I have a terrible shyness problem, and my wife will back me up on this. I would rather just stay in my dark little room over the garage and write all the time. But I've learned that when I do come out on book tour, that it should be fun and entertaining for all of us, and I do that. But to follow up on the shyness, I'm just not a joiner. I never have been. And so when I move to a new place, it is when we move to our farm, the one way that I can find my way in and have it feel natural is to join the local volunteer fire department or rescue service. And then you just begin to discover the place and the people one call at a time. That's always been true for me, and I've been very grateful for the EMS and fire service because of that.
So is it true that your mother was a firefighter before you?
We joined up at the same time. Way back when I got out of nursing school, when you come out of nursing school, anytime there's an emergency, someone says, is there a nurse in the room? Well, there is, but you're a brand new nurse. You really haven't been trained in emergencies. You just have a very broad base of knowledge. And so I thought, after about the second time that happened to me, I thought, you know, I want to learn about what you're supposed to do in a real emergency. So I signed up for EMT classes, not even planning to work on the ambulance. I just wanted the skills. And my brother decided to take the class with me. And then my mom heard that we were taking the class, and she said, I've always wanted to do something with my boys. So she took the class, and she wound up serving on a local fire department for, it was over 20 years. She just finally, she's in her late 60s, and people have just gotten bigger and bigger, and she's a small lady, and she just decided she couldn't be lifting people around anymore, so she finally retired. But yeah, she was on that department.
Well, she must have been one of the first women to do that.
No, there were people on our force already who had been doing it back in the 70s when, you know, EMS was kind of invented.
Oh, interesting. Well, she sounds like a really...
Well, part of that is just our area. I mean, you take who you can get. I mean, you take the writer guy, because even though he's on the road a lot, when he is home, he's home at 10 in the morning when everybody else is off at work. And so when I lived in my hometown of New Auburn, I made over 100 calls a year, and probably 40 or 50 of those, I was the only guy, because everyone else had day jobs. And so, yeah, you're just happy to have anybody.
Well, we're happy to have you with us today. I want to remind listeners, this is KRUU 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. Our guest today is Michael Perry, and he's talking about Visiting Tom, A Man, A Highway, and the Road to Roughneck Grace. That's his latest book. And I was wondering if you would read a little excerpt from the book for us.
Sure. Maybe I'll just read the opening prologue. That'll kind of set the stage. Tom is known for making homemade cannons and firing them. And, I mean, big ones. If you're going to visit Tom Hartwig, you'll have to drive past the cannon. Not just past it, but before it. The muzzle surveils you through the open door of his galvanized tin pole shed, poking from between a pair of manure spreaders and a homemade portable welder the size of a chest freezer. You'll be about 50 yards out when you first glimpse the artillery, and will thus have time to consider whether or not you wish to proceed directly into the field of fire. The cannon is not a lawn ornament. If you look to your left, well across the field and halfway up the hill to the tree line 200 yards distant, you will see a 4x8 sheet of white plywood with a red bullseye painted dead center. Upon closer study, you will find a pair of perforations in the plywood, one within the first ring of the bullseye, the other just outside it. The cannon is only moderately accurate, as evidenced by the number of significant divots and frayed saplings surrounding the plywood backstop. But if you care to stand up there and test the matter, you may first wish to note that when the cannonballs do hit their mark, they leave a ragged puncture through which an NFL lineman could easily stuff his fist. never leaves the cannon loaded, but newcomers will nonetheless find it daunting to motor between the target and the menacing hollow eye. "It's tough," a salesman once told Tom, "to come up your driveway with that thing parked there." "Oh," said Tom, "I never shoot at anyone coming up the driveway."
Well, that must be an interesting neighbor to live beside. Do you hear that cannon going off very often?
Oh, no, man, yeah. And I'm, like I said, I'm a couple miles away, but I'll be sitting at my writing desk, and all of a sudden there'll be a thunderous boom, and I'll know that Tom must have company.
So in the process of writing about these different people in your life, it seems to me like you have gone through a little bit of a transition. I have only read two of your books, The Truck and this one, and I do want to go back and read some of the others. But in The Truck, you wrote about this feeling of worrying that you might not recognize the moments you long for when they are happening. And in your latest book, I'm just going to read this little paragraph that you wrote. It made me think that perhaps you've gotten past that and you now feel you are recognizing those moments. "The night before the mobile coop was officially opened for business, Amy and I spread our sleeping bag on the floor and camped there overnight. We giggled and imagined we were chickens. In the dark after Amy was asleep, I smelled cool night air and kiln-dried pine, and I listened to her breath, and I deemed the present sufficient indeed." So it seems to me like that is somebody who's really recognizing. There's also a wonderful scene with fireflies when you get your children out of bed. You have two daughters. You get your children out of bed and take them out to look at fireflies with you. It seems to me like you are living a pretty interesting life now.
Well, I guess what I'd say is I'm gaining on that particular perspective. I remember, I think it might have been in my first book, Population 45, just writing about feeling breathless and like you never can capture time as it's speeding past, and you wonder when you put a tool down if you'll ever pick it up again. And I didn't mean that I had any sense of impending doom or anything, but you just realize life flies away so quickly, and so you try to, and this is so obvious it's a cliche, but you try to learn to live in the moment. And I guess what I would say about that passage that you wrote and a couple others in the book is that, yeah, I'm working on it, and I definitely now, especially with the children, I can look at them, and while on the one hand I feel time screaming away from me, I also know enough now to just go, well, this is good, though. Let's just tuck this away. And that night, the night in the chicken coop was one of those. My oldest daughter and I, we had just finished a brand new chicken coop, and before the chickens were in there, we bunked in there for a night, and it was just one of those simple good evenings.
Yeah, that sounds really fun. And the firefly scene too, I thought that was just really, you know, it is just a magical thing to see fireflies. When you share that with a child, it's doubly special.
I don't remember exactly how I wrote it, but I said, is there anything more astounding than a firefly's butt? Because it's just this ridiculous contraption that results in this indescribable beauty. And so, yeah, you got to get the kids out of bed and say, look at this.
So talking about things that are passing, your career was supported by independent bookstores. And so what do you think is happening? Are we going to keep having independent bookstores?
I think we will. I can tell you that I haven't been in this career, as you kindly put it, very long. This is my 10th year. My first book that wasn't self-published, so in other words, the first book where I went on an official book tour, came out in 2002. And I can say with sad certainty that at least 50% of the bookstores I went to on my first tour are no longer around. There's just no getting around that. On the other hand, what gives me hope is the ones that have survived are tenacious and creative and strong, and they've found a way to make themselves invaluable. And I have to live in the real world. I can't pretend that things haven't changed. Of course they have. And that change is only accelerating and permutating as we speak with the advent of e-books, which have gone from being a small percentage to really now representing a big chunk of sales. But it is my hope there will always be places, and you know, in Prairie Lights, where I'll be reading, is one of those where even a guy like me, who was not part of the insider's writer's circle and was living in Chippewa County, Wisconsin, when I heard I was going to Prairie Lights on my first book tour, I was thrilled because I knew about the reputation of that place. And it's still the same for me when I look at, you know, when the people at the publisher send me the initial list of book tour stops and I see a place like Prairie Lights, I'm eager, because not only it isn't even so much about the store being cool, which of course it is, but the people they attract are of a certain sort of people, and they're your dream audience if you're a writer. So I'm not a future teller. I don't know what's going to happen, and I think it's going to be tumultuous and tough. But yes, I do think that there's a place for independence in the books in the future, and I, of all people, hope so, because you're very right. The only reason we're even talking today is because very early on for me, it was independent booksellers who hand-sold my book. People would come in and they would introduce them to this guy from rural Wisconsin nobody had ever heard of.
So was that the first, was the first book Population 485? Was that the self-published book?
Yeah, and I don't, that was published in October 2002 by HarperCollins, and I don't remember if I went to Iowa City on the hardcover tour of the paperback, but I know I went on one of my earliest book tours. I was in Iowa City.
Was that a self-published book first? Or had you written other...
I had self-published four books, and I had also been doing a ton of magazine writing, and I had this odd story where I was on my own, no agent, nothing, and had been plugging away for about 10 years, really doing mostly just magazine pieces. My books were just collections of my magazine pieces. And then an editor or an agent in New York City read one of my essays and tracked me down in New Auburn, Wisconsin, population 485. And things kind of grew from there.
Cool. So, but what are some of the things that you... Oh, first, I want to remind listeners that you're going to be at Prairie Lights Bookstore on Friday, August 30th from 7 to 9, reading, signing, and discussing your books. That'd be a great place to go if people are interested in hearing.
And if you've not been to a reading before, you know, just come on along. You can wear, I'll say when you come to my readings, you can wear a black beret or you can wear your barn boots or you can wear both. We'll have fun. It's very relaxed. And I really, as I said before, do a lot of things that aren't in the book, and we have a nice time.
I'm sure you do. Also, I was wondering, what do you see as the difference between the independent bookstores that survive? What kind of creative things are they doing?
Well, I think they're doing a ton of different creative things, but what they seem to really be doing is focusing on, and this may sound obvious, but they're focusing on their customers and their type of customers. So they're listening to what works. And I'm also seeing creative things like, for instance, I'm doing a reading tonight where the bookseller has arranged with the photographers that did the photos for this book to have, they've had an exhibit of their photography up for almost a month now prior to the reading. And tonight the gallery that represents their work, the woman will be there to introduce me and talk about their work. And so you have, I don't know, what do you call it? Synthesis or symbioticness or something, but you got synergy. That's probably what I'm looking for. But finding different creative ways to do things. And last night I did an event where the bookseller, we had too many people to fit in the bookstore, so we do a thing at the local arts center. And in addition to having the books there and having the bookseller sign, you also, I'm coming back to do a one-man monologue show in April, and the bookstore will be part of that. And so just, there's no one thing. It's just this willingness. It's a willingness to navigate, which is really the only answer. You can't fight these changes. You just can navigate them. And I've had to do it. All writers are having to do it. We have to figure out ways to navigate these changes.
Now, were you a musician before you were a writer, or were they, did they coexist?
No, and I always, when people call me a musician, I politely decline out of respect to my friends who are true musicians. Very late in life, I learned a few chords on the guitar, and I slam away in 4/4 time. I play guitar with all the nuance of a man cut and brush. But I do, I will accept singer-songwriter, because I do write and sing all my own songs, and I have a band, and we have a little record deal with a small regional label, and we go out and play. As a matter of fact, I'll be playing tomorrow at a fair with my band, and we do all songs that I've written, and I sing. But that just grew out of the writing hours. I write long, long hours, and I would want to take a break, but I didn't want to stop my brain, and so I learned three chords, which is just enough to be dangerous. and then I'd go over in the corner and I'd fiddle around the guitar and work on a song for a while, and then go back to the book or the magazine article or the essay. And eventually I'd accumulated about, I don't know, about 30 songs, and a musician buddy of mine said, "Oh, you should play out sometime." And I said, no, I can't do that. And, but then he talked me into it, and we did a show in a coffee shop, and I ain't saying I was nervous, but I rolled out a 60-minute set and 30 minutes flat. But it didn't go awful, so we decided to do it again, and it just grew and grew, and it's very modest. We just have a small, modest following, but it's enough, and we get out and we play shows, and often I will do shows that weave book readings along with the music. I mean, there's another example of navigating. You know, how do you get people out in the seats and then sneak books in there? And So the musicians in my band are surrounding me on stage. The guy at the microphone is just a guy who writes and plays three chords in 4/4 time, pretty much.
So if people wanted to buy your music, would they find it on, like, iTunes? Where would they find it?
Yeah, it's in all those places. A lot of many independent bookstores have been carrying it, although so the distribution is available. But then probably the best place to start is just at my website, sneezingcow.com, and you go to the store page and there's a music section, and we actually have a separate section about the band and the music.
I don't think you've said the name of your band yet.
It's called The Long Beds.
The Long Beds.
Right, and The Long Beds, and that's after my 1951 International Harvester 3/4-ton long bed in pickup truck. And that's the truck I wrote about in Truck, A Love Story. And, yeah, we have fun with the music. It's been good. And I was lucky to fall in with people early on who... I used to write about musicians a lot.
You did. I remember.
Not famous ones. And so I learned so much from musicians about survival and digital times, and I learned about the creative process, and I even wound up with some fun. I had a guy in my band for a while, and he and I recorded my first album down in his basement next to a pile of his dirty socks, an album called Headwinded, and he and I recorded that together in his basement, and then he went on to be, he's downright famous these days. His name is Justin Vernon, and he has a band called Bon Iver, and he went and won 2 Grammys with his last album, and he's just this knucklehead that used to record songs with me in his basement next to his dirty socks. So very happy for him.
So
I was telling him he's going to come crawling back someday and have to be in my band again. We'll take a vote on it.
Could happen. when I was in a book club, I'm still in a couple's book club, The Truck was one of the books we read, which is perfect because the guys liked it, the women liked it, you know, it was great. And you wrote this long description of Greg Brown, and funnily enough, he happened to come to our town just shortly after that.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, he did. Unfortunately, the acoustics where he was at that time weren't perfect. Since then, that building has been, kind of changed a little, so the acoustics are better. But it was so fun to have read the description in the book and then, you know, listen to some songs online and then go to see him in person. There's nothing like homemade music, even if you're very humble, as you are, and claim that you're not a musician. It's really fun for people to get out and hear real live musicians creating music.
Yeah, I get asked all the time about the influences on me as a writer, and because I came to this backward, my influences primarily, before I got into a lot of literary influences, those influences were musical, and some of my biggest influences were singer-songwriters, but Waylon Jennings was a huge influence on me, not so much for his style, but because he taught me that you could be a roughneck country boy and still be interested in creating things artistic, and Steve Earle was a giant life changer for me, and Greg Brown is in my top five because he had this great Midwestern sensibility, and yet it has a universal appeal to it. It's not pigeonholed as such, and so and then of course he has a great appreciation for poetry and literature, and you hear that in his music all the time. And I got to interview him one time for a story for No Depression magazine, and Sandy Dias from down in your area shot some beautiful photographs to go with that, and I got to interview him right in downtown Iowa City, and while I was waiting to meet him, I went to Prairie Lights and had a coffee.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
That sounds like a really nice experience. That's the fun thing about being an interviewer. When there are people you're interested in, you can try to seek them out and see if you can talk to them for a while.
My favorite story about that is I interviewed him on a park bench somewhere down there, in that pedestrian area in front of one of the hotels, I think it was. And while I'm interviewing him, every once in a while, there'd be this bizarre rumble coming through the park bench, and I could feel it in my back. And I, c- couldn't figure it out because I thought, well, Iowa City, surely they don't have a subway. I mean, a literal subway under the ground. And I couldn't figure it out. And then I realized what it was. It was every time he started talking, his voice is so deep that it was vibrating the back of the park bench.
Wow. So. Interesting. So what are you working on now? Or tell us a little bit about your schedule, because you're farming, you're raising a family, and you're doing all this traveling to promote your books. So does that...
Yeah, well, in the new book, Visiting Tom, I do go to... I very specifically talk about the farming thing, because I'm, for purposes of promotional shorthand, I'm often referred to as a writer/farmer, and I have a section in there where I explain the farming out of respect to my friends who truly are farmers. I'm a writer. That's how I pay the rent, and by performing and writing, and I do raise, we have a whole bunch of chickens right now, and we usually raise a bunch of meat chickens every year, and we do raise our own pig, but just a handful of them. But this year, for instance, I'm on book tour most of the fall, so I couldn't have pigs this year because I'm gone right during the finishing and butchering season. And I just said in the book that, you know, I do have a farm and I do raise some animals, but if I come home from book tour and all my pigs are dead, that's a bad weekend. But if you're a real farmer, you quite literally bet the farm on the outcome. And so we balance it, and when I have to cut back on the farming end of things, I do. And I don't know, it's just I feel like the luckiest goofball ever. I had no intentions of doing any of this. I'm not a big shot. I'm not famous, but our little family is able to make a living between me writing books and magazine articles and going around talking and playing music. And we're like any self-employed family. And my wife is absolutely my partner in this. She's, when I'm on these book tours, she's keeping everything running at home. And I just would be lost without her. So.
Are there ground rules of how much you can write about your wife and your daughters?
There never have been. They're self-imposed is what they are. And specific to my daughters, there's a writer once, and I've got to find his name because I'm always citing this, and I always go blank on his name, but he wrote for years about his wife and two daughters. And then I was reading a piece by him one time where he said he promised his daughters that once they turned 12, he would stop writing about them and not write about them again until they were out of college, because he said nobody deserves to be written about during their teenage years. And I'm not going to stick to that 100%, but I've already begun it in this last book. I pull the lens away from them a little bit just because my oldest daughter is now 12 and she's about to become a teenager. And I think he's right. I think it's a fine line between using their stories to speak to a larger story and also just plain giving them their privacy. So there aren't any... I haven't been given any ground rules yet. The only ground rule my wife has is she hasn't read all of my books, which is part of why I was attracted to her. But she does say, if you're going to write about me, I do want to see what you said first. And so I usually run it past her.
They did play a lesser role. Your family played a little bit of a lesser role in Visiting Tom, but it's still a very interesting book. It has these great black and white photos. And I want to remind listeners that my guest today is Michael Perry. You're listening to Writers' Voices on KRUU 100.1 FM. Broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa. We're a community solar-powered radio station. So you have had to embrace this new age of publishing. Is there anything different about writing a book that's going to also be an e-book, or does it make no difference at all?
In my case, no difference at all, because I've realized the only thing that keeps people interested in my case is that the writing has to stack up to the last batch of writing. And that's true even with, I'm under no illusions, for instance, about my band. The reason we got our little record deal and the reason that people started coming to our shows is because first they read the book. So they said, well, we'll give the music a shot. And so I never, ever forget that if I don't devote my fullest attention to the writing, the rest of it will all just start to dissipate. And I think it is a mistake. Now, let me be clear that obviously there are some cases where the electronic book is, of course, a completely different animal. And I'm thinking of some of the wonderful children's books that my daughters have been looking into digitally. But on the other hand, in my case, it just has to be good writing, and you just have to pay attention to that. And there's no amount of bells or whistles or cutesy stuff or pictures or hyperlinks that are going to take the place of well-crafted writing. And even I don't necessarily, of course I care if people like my books, but what I really want, even if it isn't their favorite piece of writing, I do want them to come away feeling like I worked really hard on it and tried to give them my heart and my time. So that doesn't change for me.
Do you write many drafts, or is this process where you're piecing things together once you've got it and you put it back on your computer after it's been in these pieces on the table? Is that sort of done, or then do you go through and do another filter?
Oh, no, because my favorite part of writing is revision. I love to revise, and as a matter of fact, my editors are always saying, you know what, it's just time, hand it in already. Because I love to go over each sentence 65 times and try moving one word back three spaces and see what happens. And does a humorous line get funnier if you use this word at the beginning of the sentence or at the end of the sentence? And is a line that's trying to be heartfelt, does it work better if it's moved up in the paragraph or down? And I talked about I love to read them out loud and listen for the rhythm. And you could do that forever and go into an endless loop and lose the house. So at some point, you have to stop. But no, I spend as much time on revision as anything because I so love the product. It's like you've done all the heavy lifting, and now you can just work on the pretty parts.
So where does a book start with you? Like, at some point, did you think, oh, I think I'm going to write about Tom and the cannons and... you know, how he has all these materials.
It's a couple of different things, and the one, not to be crass, but as a self-employed writer, you got to find something that you think people will be interested in. And my job, first of all, is to convince the publisher. I mean, I have to still pitch ideas to the publisher, and they've rejected as many of my ideas as they've accepted. And it's not adversarial. It's just the way it works. And so, first of all, I try to say, well, is there something that they'll be interested in and therefore hope that readers will be interested in? And then the second thing is it does have to be something I care about. And obviously, I really cared. I care about Tom, but I cared even more about just being able to take a shot at capturing some of these, you know, people like him. And I write in there about his kitchen. And I wanted to write about country, old country kitchens and how they feel and why you feel comfortable in them. And so that would be the second element. It just has to be something I'm interested in. And then from the idea of the book to the finish, it always evolves and changes. I mean, my initial idea with this book was to write about 10 different old-timers, and I quickly realized that got completely out of hand and was not going to work again. So I just settled back in on focusing on one person.
So when you're pitching these ideas, and some of them are rejected, so you just take that in stride, and then...
Yes, you know, I have to always be careful when I say this, because I don't want to sound heartless or uncaring, because, of course, rejection is never fun, and you know, getting a negative review is never fun, no matter how long you've been doing it, and you can maybe get 5 wonderful reviews, but that 6th negative one will ruin the rest of your week, and it shouldn't. You should be better than that, but it still bothers you. But it's also just part of the deal, and so we're I don't mean to sound like I'm just blown off the question, but I'll have people sometimes say, well, I really want to be a writer, but I really have a hard time with rejection. I just want to say, well, you know, that's just part of the gig, and so I can take it. Surely you can take it, because I'm kind of wimpy about it, and I can still take it. And rejection is just part of the atmosphere if you're going to breathe in this particular room. So... it'll bug you a little bit, but it's just part of the deal. I work with a magazine editor I've worked with for over 10 years, and he's rejected more things than he's accepted, and it's never personal. It's just, this isn't going to work. And I have a wonderful editor at HarperCollins who, with this particular book, one of the fun things I've been doing at the readings this go-around is I got a couple of things she cut from the book, and so I read them just to say, well, here's something my editor didn't want in there, and it's mostly jokey and fun, but that's just part of the process.
So
and there's a difference between being precious and protective of your work and sticking up for it. I mean, there are times when an editor will want something out, and I'll stick up for it. I'll say, no, I really think that belongs in there. And then there are other times when I go, yeah, you're right. And in many cases, editors, and certainly copy editors, make me look smarter than I am.
So in your reference to navigating publishing today, I noticed that you have, it looked like a TV show with Wisconsin Public TV. Is that right? Where you had...
Those are kind of intermittent. I was out on book tour, and I did an interview with Wisconsin Public Television, and afterwards a producer approached me and asked if I'd be willing to do little humorous video essays now and then, and gosh, that's coming up on, I think we've been doing that for 8 or 9 years, and so it's not a regular gig, but I do, like we just have been talking about, scheduling a couple of more this coming winter, and they just come up to my farm or wherever I'm living up north, and we head outside, and I just start talking.
Do you like script those? I watched a few of them, and I couldn't tell if you were just making stuff up as you were there, or if you kind of like script it ahead of time. And
the first couple, if you look at the old ones, I would write a script, and I would get all, and then I realized that it was really coming off like that. And so now, generally have an idea. I maybe have 4 or 5 lines that I know I want to make sure and say, but then I just make myself find my way because it comes across much more naturally.
So how do you feel about developing those skills, like becoming a musician and then becoming, I don't know what you would call it, a videographer? I mean, I don't know what that it is that you're, but doing these...
I think you just go with what works. I mean, my number one favorite thing is to sit all alone in a little room and write. But I also would be a churl if I was complaining about doing video essays and, you know, tomorrow, in the midst of a book tour where I'm all alone, driving all over the country, all of a sudden tomorrow I get to pull into this fairgrounds. I have no idea what to expect. All they've told us is that there's a horse pull, and as soon as the horse pull is over, we'll drag your stage on. So I have no idea what to expect, but I know that my band's going to be there, and I'm friends with my band, and it's like this wonderful little reunion for me on the road, and then it's back to book tour. And so all these other avenues have given me all these new joys, and to be able to appreciate the work of musicians from the stage in real time and see, like, people don't always know it, but they're often rescuing me if I've forgotten a lyric or maybe I played a wrong chord, and while no one else is noticing, they're basically buoying me up and helping me find my way back to where I'm supposed to be. And to be able to observe that stuff up close, even as a writer, it's a blast. And so I've never really given it much thought. It's all just kind of happened, and I've gone with it.
Well, it sounds like you've worked hard and you've forged a life that it sounds really satisfying for you and your family. And I
never lose. I'm so grateful that we can do this because I never set out to do it. But yeah, I'm not gonna. I mean, I'll be pretty self-deprecating, but I'll also say, yeah, I've worked really hard. And for the first 10 years, I was a single guy living on absolutely nothing. I mean, we're talking low 4-figure tax returns on the gross income side.
Well, I'm glad that
every minute of it. And now that I got married late in life, and I have a little family, and we're making it, and we're just finding our way, and I'm grateful. I can look back, you know, you talk about the video stuff. Well, the only reason I'm comfortable with that is that as part of my early survival, I worked with a guy and helped him write local television ads, and so I learned about production, and I learned about videography from helping on those little ads. Well, never dreaming that it would help me 10 years later when I was shooting video essays or working on a book trailer with a guy who is known for making music videos. And so,
well, we've come to the end of our time, but you never can tell when those things are going to help you later in life, so it's just good to have a good attitude about whatever comes your way. Michael Perry has been our guest today on Writer's Voices. He's going to be at Prairie Lights Bookstore 7 to 9 on Friday, August 30th. I'm sure he'll give you a good show if you go and join him. Thanks for being with us, Michael.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for all the time. It's fun to be able to shoot the breeze at length.
Writer's Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, Cheryl Fusco-Johnson, and Corey Hickenbottom. Archives are available at KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com. Writer's Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.